When I was a little girl, I was a huge fan of the Little House on the Prairie books and the Anne of Green Gables books and everything that Louisa May Alcott ever wrote. And of course, those are all, in fact, late 19th century women's history, which is now my field. So I think that there's a pretty clear line there, even though I didn't recognize it at the time.
What drew you to those books?
They had real people as protagonists. They weren't, you know, the Sweet Valley High stories where it was these silly, vapid girls who cared about nothing except clothes and getting a boyfriend. And they weren't, well, boys, like in the Hardy Boys. They were girls who were real people and did real things and confronted real issues, like Anne of Green Gables being an orphan and being brilliant in school but being teased because she had long red braids, right? I mean, that was something that, although I did not have long red braids, I could identify with.
Nancy Drew?
I read Nancy Drew. I like Trixie Belden more because Trixie Belden is more of a working class protagonist, also more of a rural protagonist. I grew up in rural West Virginia. Pretty hard to identify with a girl who gets a convertible on her 16th birthday.
Well, 2014 is the 100th anniversary of suffrage in Montana. Anya, can you put that in perspective for us? What was daily life like for the average Montana woman 100 years ago?
I guess I would begin with a caveat that I'm not sure there was an average Montana woman, right? So that a woman's daily experience was going to differ tremendously based on whether she was white or native, also based on whether she lived in a rural or an urban setting. So an urban, well-to-do white woman like, say, Jeanette Rankin could expect to go through high school. Going to college was still a pretty big step, something that most girls had to really work at convincing their parents to allow them to do. But it was a new opportunity. And when Rankin graduated from the University of Montana in 1902, she was part of this cohort of the first generation of women college graduates.
Now for rural women, mm-hmm. poor, and Native women.
We are actually fortunate enough to have a diary of a woman named Edith Renault, who lived in the Big Hole and kept a daily diary in 1917. She was, I believe, 20 years old at the time. And Edith Renault's diary is a diary of weather and work. Every single entry begins with a description of the weather, which was often fairly extreme in the Big Hole in January in particular, and then continues with a description of the separate but equally necessary work activities of the male and female members of the household. Edith's own work focused on baking, so the way that she measured her accomplishments each day was to tally up the number of loaves of bread she had baked that day.
Important work.
Extremely.
And then the men ranching, farming.
Right, so that the men would do the majority of the outdoor work, although women usually pitched in at sort of peak times, right, like haying. But in order to feed all of those male workers, there needed to be a great deal of domestic labor inside the home. And in Edith Renault's case, that domestic labor mostly translated into baking.
What about Native women?
So at the same time that well-to-do white women like Jeanette Rankin were enjoying new opportunities for higher education and political participation and perhaps professional careers, if they so chose, Native American women, along with Native Americans as a group, were facing severe constraints under the reservation system and then difficulties under the allotment system that followed the reservation system. Federal agents, who were men, controlled access to food. So the deal, if you will, between the U.S. government and local tribes was that the tribes would agree to be cordoned off onto reservations, which curtailed their ability to make their living in traditional ways, such as hunting and gathering. And in return, the federal government would provide them with a food allowance. But the federal agents were often very stingy with those food allowances. So there's a Northern Cheyenne woman named Iron Teeth who complained she was always hungry. She never had enough to eat, that the agent frequently denied her food, and more to the point, that she was in something like her 90s at the time, and she had to travel on foot some ungodly distance to even get to the agent and ask for food, only to be turned away. So she complained quite bitterly about that. So food was a major tool in the kind of power struggle between the federal government and the local peoples.
Okay, so 1914.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
1914. Well, 1914 was not the first time that Montana women had agitated for the right to vote. They had actually agitated for the right to vote when Montana first became a state, but they were unsuccessful at that time, and they got what was known as the school vote, or a form of limited suffrage in which they could vote in school elections. They could also run for positions on the school board, which is why you end up with people like Helen Clark actually being elected as superintendent of schools in Helena in like 1882, which is what, 22 years earlier? 32 years earlier than women were allowed to vote.
And a Native woman on top of that.
Yes.
There's got to be a story there.
There is. So Helen Clark was the daughter of a Blackfeet woman and a Scottish merchant. She had been sent east for her education, and she was extraordinarily well-educated. She definitely had that upper-crust, eastern elite education. So once she had briefly pursued a career on the stage back in the east, she then returned to Montana, and through the intervention of some family friends, white family friends, she became a school teacher and then ran for election and was actually reelected two more times. But even though she served three terms in total, she was never really fully accepted in Helena. So Helena's white society ladies really shunned her. And then another really fascinating wrinkle is that after she completed her terms as superintendent in the school system, she got a job, oddly enough, with the federal government as an allotment agent. And the job of an allotment agent, of course, was to go from community to community and try to convince Native peoples to subdivide their reservation into allotments, into smaller tracts, and then assign those tracts to individual owners rather than the tribe having collective ownership of the reservation. And then whatever land was left over, so-called surplus land, would be sold off to whites. So this is why, for instance, in the Flathead, we have this kind of checkerboard pattern of settlement. Well, many Native peoples objected to allotment, not surprisingly, and Native men in particular were very hostile to Helen Clark because here she was, a Native woman, but working for the federal government, trying to assert authority over them, and she was only a woman, they said, so she doesn't have the authority to do this. And then, in yet another twist, in her later life, Helen Clark had no job, was trying and failing to get another contract with the federal government, moved back to Montana again, and had to apply for an allotment for herself. And at that point, she was writing letters about how she was facing starvation in her old age.
And stories like this are in this political timeline that's being featured right now.
They are. She's also featured in the traveling exhibit that is currently under development.
Yeah, tell us about the traveling exhibit.
Sure. The traveling exhibit is a project of the Montana Woman Suffrage Centennial Committee. And the idea is to create an exhibit that is very portable and can travel around the state. So the exhibit is designed on 10 panels that sort of roll up into their own cases so that they don't require difficult or complicated setup. And once the exhibit is completed, it will tour the state to a certain number of locations that have already requested it, but it will then be donated to the Montana State Library so that small towns and local historical societies and schools and universities and colleges, you name it, can essentially order it and be able to display it in their community free of cost.
And I wish we had time to go through some of the stories panel by panel, but the topics of these panels include what?
Some of the really important topics are tribal politics, the state campaign for woman suffrage, racism in the movement, opposing forces of the anti-suffrage movement, and also Montana women's participation in the national woman suffrage campaign.
Racism in the suffrage movement?
Yes.
Explain that.
I just did this in class yesterday, and you should have seen my students' faces fall. So the suffrage movement actually originated out of the abolitionist movement, the movement to abolish race-based slavery within the boundaries of the United States. And as such, most of the early suffragists adhered to this notion of natural rights and based their arguments on the idea that as human beings, men and women were co-equal and that women were therefore inherently endowed with natural rights, which should include all of the rights of citizenship, including the right to vote. Unfortunately, after the Civil War, there was a great deal of debate over what was going to happen in the newly reunited United States. Ultimately, the Reconstruction Amendments enfranchised African American men, left out all women, left out Native Americans, and women who had been part of the abolitionist movement, who had been looking to extend citizenship rights to former slaves, were very angry that women were not just overlooked, but really quite intentionally excluded from the Reconstruction Amendments and the way in which they redefined and extended citizenship. There was a long period, a 2 or 3 decade period of dissension and division within the suffrage movement. And by the time it reunited in 1890, that generation of abolitionist feminists was aging, if still alive at all. And the new generation really adopted different arguments. So they adopted arguments based on both gender difference and race difference. For gender difference, instead of arguing on the basis of natural rights, which were shared by all, men, women, black, white, you get the idea, they argued that women should have the right to vote because they were different from men. Because unlike men, they would bring the concerns of home and family into politics. And as the housekeepers of the world, they would clean up the dirty world of American politics. They also began to adopt a number of arguments suggesting that educated, white, native-born women were more deserving of the vote than uneducated former slaves, new immigrants to the country. And they began to exhibit some pretty racist language.
What made your students' jaws drop? Any example come to mind?
It may have been when I quoted Jeanette Rankin saying that African Americans were a child race. That was most unfortunate. It's not unique to her. Suffragists all over the country in every region did this and sort of had these elaborate calculations in which they would urge white men to vote for suffrage because there were more white women in that state than there were black voters or than there were immigrant voters. And so if the men enfranchised the women, that would ensure white dominance. Rankin was not alone in this, but of course, that's not how we usually think of Jeanette Rankin in Montana.
Oh, no, she's put on such a pedestal in this state.
Right.
And that's got to be disappointing to people when they hear that for the first time.
Yes, they were very upset.
As not perfect as the movement may have been, as you've illustrated, women, young women today, very little appreciation or knowledge, do you think, of all the work that happened so long ago?
I think, unfortunately, most people, young, old, men, women, have very little knowledge of how much it took for women to achieve the right to vote in this country. Mm. So I hope that these exhibits will educate all Montanans about how much work went into achieving the rights of citizenship and how important it is to exercise and protect those rights of citizenship.
How can people find out more about these exhibits?
They can learn more about both exhibits at the Women's History Matters Project, which is at montanawomenshistory.org. They can also learn about the exhibits, both of the exhibits, at the Women's and Gender Studies website at U of M. And once the exhibit is ready for touring, they can contact Joe Flick at the State Library in Helena at jflick@mt.gov to reserve the exhibit for their community.
Anya Jabbour, Professor of History at the University of Montana, Co-Director of Women's and Gender Studies. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.